From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, twin car bombs kill 118 people. That's in Nigeria. Is international intervention needed in Libya?
Diplomatically comes and says, you gotta get your act together or dot.
Speculation continues over what caused the deaths in the Odessa fire in Ukraine. The U.S. says it's up to China how cyber espionage charges impact bilateral relations. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Nigerian officials say the bodies of 118 people have been recovered from the scene of a twin bombing in the crowded business section of the central city of Jos. The blast, which occurred Tuesday at a busy marketplace, flattened several buildings and caused fires that were still burning hours later. Officials expect to find more bodies. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan called the bombings cruel and evil and said he is fully committed to winning the war on terrorism. No one has claimed responsibility, but suspicion immediately fell on Boko Haram, the Islamist extremist group blamed for thousands of deaths as it tries to set up a conservative Muslim state in the north. Distraught mothers of the 276 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram nearly 5 weeks ago have expressed hope that the country's government will find them and bring them home. Martha Mark, who is married to the local pastor, broke into tears when she talked about her kidnapped daughter, Monica. Like many of those involved, Martha does not believe the Nigerian military is doing enough to rescue the girls. They were kidnapped in the town of Chibok, where one of the community leaders, Malen Dunama, said the residents of the town feel helpless.
It is possible they can come and kidnap the whole village and go away with it. What can we do? We don't have ammunition, only we have sticks, bow and arrow. We cannot stand these people.
Of the more than 300 girls and young women who were kidnapped from their boarding school, 53 escaped. A week ago, Boko Haram posted a video online which showed the schoolgirls and claiming they had all converted to Islam. Joy Bashara was one among those who managed to escape.
Many of them, I recognize them. Some of them, all of them, we are in the same class. Some of them are my friends. I recognize many among them.
Esther Yakubu, whose daughter is being held hostage, is angered that government forces have taken more than a month to enter the Sambisi Forest, which, according to witnesses and unverified reports, could be where the girls are held.
Up to now, nobody have ever entered that Sambisa, and they say they know where those girls are. But up to now, no any response, no any soldier that we hear that entered that Sambisa up to today.
Nigeria's military insists that it is diligently searching for the girls and says near daily aerial bombardments of the forest were stopped to avoid accidentally hitting the girls. Leaders from Nigeria's neighboring countries met at a French-organized summit last weekend in Paris to coordinate curtailing the Boko Haram insurgency that threatens the region. Libya's Electoral Commission has announced that it will hold national parliamentary elections on June 25th. Libyan lawmakers met Tuesday in an effort to reassert control in the wake of challenges from supporters of rogue general Khalifa Haftar. Karim Mizran is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafik Hariri Center for the Middle East. We asked for his reaction to announcement of the parliamentary elections.
Well, at first I was stuttered because I don't think that in the midst of this confusion there is the possibility to organize a free and fair and regular elections throughout the whole country. But maybe there is an agreement behind the curtains of which we are not aware to calm down the situation and re-legitimize the Libyan institutions. It would be a good development if free and fair and regular elections could be held so soon, which is something we advocated since the beginning. It would re-legitimize the National Assembly and probably have a government of which is going to be more consensual and more the product of a consensus among the population rather than the ones we have, which are by now partial and parochial.
Do you believe the conflict in this nation could possibly lead to civil war?
If it continues this way, if the attacks against the Islamists in the East continues and clashes in Tripoli take place and the Misrata militias are drawn in, it definitely can by rollers into a civil war. I don't think so. I think that the fact that the Misrata militias are taking their time and are not moving in towards Tripoli or the east means that there is a will to negotiate before everything collapses.
Do you have optimism that there can be democracy in Libya in a few years' time?
Yes, I'm optimistic regarding that. We have to overcome the difficulties of the very first moment. That's why I'm pessimistic in the short term, in the sense that unless the international community really exercises strong efforts in order to act as a mediator, as a third-party mediator in the situation and forces everybody to come to the table, I'm afraid that the parochialism and local interest and personal ambitions may clash and prolong the situation of disorder for another year or two.
Is there anything the international community should do or just keep out of it?
No, they should intervene with strength. What I just said, they should intervene with all the weight they can in order to force everybody to come to the table and sign a negotiated agreement to produce a roadmap for the solution of this problem. And only a third, the international community as a third party can really do that. There is no such a figure in the Libyan political environment. They cannot look like that.
Well, would this be a military activity, or do you mean diplomatic?
No, I mean diplomatic, but strong diplomatic. Diplomatic that comes and says, you got to get your act together, or ...
Karim Mezran, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. Fighting in Libya has left at least 70 people dead since Friday. The country has experienced chronic unrest since longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi was ousted from power in 2011. In Washington Tuesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki was asked about tensions in Libya.
We do not condone or support the actions on the ground, and nor have we assisted with these actions. Mm-hmm. So we are continuing to call on all parties to refrain from violence and to seek resolution through peaceful means. There are a range of mechanisms to do that through the international community. We've been in touch with, of course, the interim government there. Mm-hmm. David Satterfield was just on the ground. He's back in Washington now, mm-hmm. But he had a range of meetings while he was there. And we're still gathering information on what is also a very fluid situation.
Psaki said the United States will continue to evaluate developments in Libya.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. VOAnews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Ukraine's government says 32 pro-Russian activists who died during a fire in a building they had taken over early this month in Odessa may have been killed by chloroform poisoning and not by flames or smoke. The revelation fueled speculation about what happened during day-long clashes on May 2nd. But VOA's Al Pessin reports from Odessa, people seem eager not to return to the level of emotion that led to the violence.
The trade union's building at Kulikovo Field bears the scars of a raging fire, and the communist flag raised by pro-Russian protesters still flies on the roof behind a Ukrainian flag placed at half-staff to mark their deaths. Inside, the intensity of the fire is clear, and barricades the pro-Russian protesters used to block the doors helped fuel it. But photos of the dead, too graphic to show, indicate some of them died in unusual positions, apparently not trying to flee or protect themselves from the fire. And many of the rooms were not burned, and some exits are clear. On Monday, Ukraine's deputy interior minister said the victims may have died from chloroform poisoning, and the investigation into how that might have happened is continuing. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov expressed outrage and accused Ukrainian authorities of lying to cover up the involvement of foreign mercenaries. Odessa's regional vice governor, Zoya Kazanji, told VOA there's no tolerance for such interference.
No, this is, My attitude is obviously extremely negative. At high levels, we are constantly saying this is our business. Unfortunately, I think the political conditions and the behavior of senior Russian officials is causing a situation where we will hardly be able to be brothers and sisters and friendly nations in the foreseeable future.
Journalist Oksana Butuk says the Russian approach will backfire even among Odessa's pro-Russian activists.
People who are still gathering at Kulikova Field always say they're there because they want to be there and that Russia has nothing to do with it. And when Russia tries to get involved, people get aggressive because they're always saying Russia is not involved.
People who still come to pay their respects at the Kulikova Field building are emotional, but even they don't talk about seceding from Ukraine like activists in some areas farther east do.
Ukraine is Ukraine. No one was going to separate it in the way the media shows it, mostly national media. Odessa was never for the separation of Ukraine.
Monday's revelations are fueling doubt and anger at the authorities, but Vice Governor Kazanji says they will not likely spark more violence.
The most important thing is to know the truth of what happened, because it's the only thing that could somehow, if not reconcile the city, at least calm people down, because the truth is always calming.
So she and the rest of the new regional government are focused on completing the investigation in the hope that speculation about the horrors of May 2nd doesn't lead to more of the same. Al Pessin, VOA News, Odessa.
Donetsk in eastern Ukraine is a cosmopolitan city, home to Tatars, Jews, Turks, Greeks, and international students who come from all over the world to study medicine. But some among the city's minorities fear that increased Russian influence will lead to intolerance of ethnic and religious diversity. Patrick Wells is in Donetsk with more.
After 6 long years of study, these Jordanian students have finally qualified as medical doctors. But this isn't a university in Amman. This is Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Thousands of students from around the world have come here to take advantage of affordable tuition fees. But now the university is telling them to go home, fearing it can't guarantee their safety in the current political climate.
Before now and now, I think for now it's more tense. Before there were risks that we went through. But now it gets more high. We have many risks now we are facing.
Some students say they faced increased suspicion and racist abuse since the pro-Russian separatist movement began. Michael, a dentistry student from Botswana, says separatists recently shouted racial slurs at him and his friends in the street.
Especially us, as in black people. I was in a situation last time where I was associated with Obama. Because we are of the same color, they hate that guy, so they thought we should just go back to our countries, just like that. So it's very difficult in that situation.
Donetsk is also home to Tatars, Armenians, Azerbaijanis, Greeks and Jews, many of whom say they've enjoyed increased freedom of identity and religion since the fall of the Soviet Union. Mufti Sayyid Ismagilov heads the local Muslim community on the outskirts of Donetsk. He says Muslims in Ukraine enjoy many more rights and freedoms than their co-religionists across the border in Russia.
The most important reason why we support Ukraine is that there are many rights and freedoms for us here in Ukraine, which give us the opportunity to develop here. If we compare Ukraine and Russia, here is much better.
Ismagilov also fears what separation from Ukraine and increased Russian influence here might mean for the region's many religious and ethnic minorities.
There was and there still is trust between people from different religions and cultures, Christians, Jews, and atheists. We can easily find a common language. There is no xenophobia, fascism, or racism here. There are no skinheads like in Russia.
As preparations continue for this Sunday's presidential election, many hope the results will create a system of governance that will continue to protect the rights of minorities. But election officials say they're already facing intimidation and threats in parts of eastern Ukraine, and it's unclear whether the vote will go ahead in these areas. Patrick Wells, VOA News, Donetsk, Ukraine.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The United States says it's up to China how charges of cyber espionage aimed at five Chinese military personnel will affect bilateral relations. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Beijing has suspended cooperation in the China-U.S. Cyber Working Group and continues to criticize the United States for hypocrisy, referring to it as the number one intelligence power.
U.S. Defense spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby told a Pentagon news briefing Tuesday the United States has regular discussions with China at all levels of government about cyber spying, an issue, he said, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel brought up during his April visit. Kirby said, to the degree the latest indictments affect the relationship, that is a decision the Chinese have to make.
We still desire, from a military perspective, to further grow and develop the military-to-military relationship and to find ways to have a more productive conversation about these very tough issues. And cyber is one of them. They announced that they pulled out of the cyber working group. That's regrettable. It's a decision they made. It wasn't a decision they had to make. But this is a tough issue we don't always agree on. But it's one that we got to keep the dialogue and the conversations open on. And the Secretary firmly believes in still doing that.
Kirby said the United States has no desire to militarize cyberspace. He said with countries like China who are active in cyber, Washington wants to have as open and as transparent a conversation about it as possible. The United States Monday announced it had charged five Chinese military officers with conducting economic espionage against American companies. The Justice Department accused a unit of China's People's Liberation Army of hacking into the computers of U.S. companies working in nuclear technology, solar power, and the steel industry. Beijing has rejected the criminal allegations, the first ever leveled by the United States against a foreign power for cyber crimes targeting American businesses. China's defense ministry accused the United States of having ulterior motives and denounced what it said was Washington's hypocrisy and double standards. Wednesday, the state-run Global Times said the allegations come from a country that spies both at home and abroad, adding that it has been taking bold steps in cyber espionage and referred to former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden, who publicized classified documents that revealed global U.S. surveillance programs. Snowden has been charged with espionage and currently lives in Russia. The Global Times said those documents show the U.S. hacked into China's backbone networks, universities, government departments, and other organs. It applauded the suspension of the China-U.S. Cyber Working Group and called for further action. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki, during a give-and-take with reporters Tuesday, expressed hope the next strategic and economic dialogue between the two countries in Beijing in July will go on as planned.
We're hopeful that we can maintain a dialogue with China about cybersecurity and a range of other issues.
Well, they've suspended this dialogue, and you still expect the Chinese are going to be cooperative with you?
We believe there are a range of issues that we work closely together on. We've seen the concerns they've expressed. We believe we have a relationship on a range of important economic, strategic, security issues, and we're looking forward to the SNED.
The Associated Press reports the hacking techniques allegedly used against American companies were not complicated. They tricked employees to open email attachments or click on website links. Cedric Layton, a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, currently a cybersecurity consultant, said the American public, as well as government and private sector employees, are still ill-prepared to guard against such hacking techniques.
The real problem that we find is that it is not only easy to convince people to click on an email link or do something that they shouldn't be doing, but it is also an increasingly common way in which cyber adversaries can gain intelligence on a network, can use it as a platform for other types of cyber attacks, and quite frankly, it's also a platform that they use to steal tons of intellectual property, and it's a global problem that is really in crying out for a global response at this point.
Layton said U.S. companies doing business in China face the possibility of economic retaliation, such as reverse engineering some of their products, making it difficult for them to maintain their market share in China. Reuters news agency reports firms like IBM Corporation and Cisco Systems have already seen their sales drop as China turns more to internal suppliers. Layton, however, says China's charge of U.S. hypocrisy is ineffective, given that U.S. government entities are barred by law from engaging in commercial espionage. He says that distinction does not exist in China. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The 2014 hurricane season predictions are due out this week. They're expected to show general weather trends over the next 6 months. But the accuracy of such long-range forecasts is often criticized, especially when they turn out to be wrong. For this story, we travel to the U.S. Satellite Operations Facility near Washington to get a closer look at the tools meteorologists use to make their forecasts. Here is VOA's Roseanne Scurble.
Tom Boyd sits before a bank of computers that streams live data from weather satellites.
As we speak, we're looking at what is happening on the satellite. This schedule is actually happening on the satellite. It tells the imager and sounder when to start and stop and where to scan at over the U.S.
The imager works like a camera in space, and the sounder measures the temperature radiated from clouds, oceans, and air. Boyd is among the dozens of aerospace engineering technicians in the control room who gather that data and make sure the satellites run properly around the clock.
Earlier, we had a special event on this particular satellite. We just kind of brought it out of semi-storage and just started up the schedule, so we're expecting to see a few limits flag out until the thing settles down to satellite, probably over the next 24-hour period.
NOAA's fleet includes 16 satellites. Some remain in a set position over the United States. Others constantly circle the globe. The challenge is to get as accurate a picture of the atmosphere as possible, says Mike Condre, deputy director of NOAA's Office of Satellite Operations.
They give you the temperature, the winds, the humidity, the kind of information, and that is data is put into the computer models that the National Weather Service runs, and those computer models are what give people the long-term forecasts, 3 days, 5 days, 7 day forecasts to prepare.
And those long-term forecasts can save lives.
Every time we see a hurricane, every time we see any kind of severe weather out there, that underscores the importance to the folks out here on the floor of what they do every day.
Condre expects predictions to get even better with the launch of the Joint Polar Satellite System in early 2017.
What these will provide is about an order of magnitude, in other words, about 10 times more volume of data on the atmospheric state of the winds, the temperature, and the humidity in the atmosphere.
That information will improve the day-to-day forecast. Seasonal forecasts rely on even more data sources. In addition to satellites, they depend on ocean buoys that record sea temperatures and observations from ships. NOAA and Colorado State University issue annual hurricane reports to let planners and the public know what to expect. Warmer than normal waters in the tropical Pacific generally indicate fewer storms in the Atlantic. CSU research scientist Philip Klotzbach mines the tropical Atlantic for similar clues. He spoke via Skype.
If the waters are warmer than normal, that tends to mean there's more fuel for the developing storms. If the atmospheric pressures are lower than normal, that tends to mean that the atmosphere is more unstable and more conducive for storms to form and to intensify.
But errors do occur. An active Atlantic hurricane season was predicted last year. That didn't happen.
It is certainly very difficult to predict and is very complicated because the atmosphere and the ocean interact in a very complicated manner, and you have to take into account a lot of these complicated relationships when you're issuing these seasonal predictions.
But Klotzbach says mistakes better inform the next forecast, adding prediction remains an inexact science. Roseanne Scurble, VOA News, Washington.
Police in Tehran have arrested six Iranians for posting a dance video featuring American singer Pharrell Williams' hit song Happy on the internet. Clip shows three men and three unveiled women singing and dancing to the song. Tehran's police chief called the dance video a vulgar clip, which hurt public chastity. The singer, Pharrell Williams, tweeted that it is beyond sad the six were arrested for trying to spread happiness. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey, reporting to you from Washington.
This is Today in History. On May 21st, 1840, Navy Captain William Hobson formally declared New Zealand a British colony. Hobson became New Zealand's first governor. In 1856, the Midwestern town of Lawrence, Kansas, on the American frontier, was captured and burned by pro-slavery forces. The battle between opponents and proponents of slavery led the state to be known as Bleeding Kansas. In 1863, the Seventh-day Adventist Church was organized in Battle Creek, Michigan. The church is distinct from other Protestant denominations in that its members observe Saturday, the seventh day of the week, as the day of worship rather than Sunday. Today, the SDA Church has millions of members worldwide. In 1881, the American Red Cross was established by Clara Barton in Washington, D.C. Football's governing body, FIFA, was organized on this day in 1904. Representatives from seven European football associations met to arrange an international tournament, but it wasn't until 1930 that the first World Cup was held. In 1908, the first horror movie, a silent version of the Robert Louis Stevenson classic Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, premiered in Chicago, Illinois. In 1924, University of Chicago students Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold Jr. murdered 14-year-old Bobby Franks in a thrill killing. It became one of the most notorious murders of the 20th century and provided the basis for the movie Rope. In 1991, Ethiopia's Marxist president, Mengistu Haile Mariam, resigned and fled his country under pressure from advancing rebels. The dictator oversaw the Ethiopian Red Terror in the 1970s, in which thousands were killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Events in Ukraine have made clear that Europe still lives in a dangerous world. There is no postmodern refuge immune to the threat of military force, said U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. And we cannot take for granted, even in Europe, that peace is underwritten by the credible deterrent of military power. In the short term, the Transatlantic Alliance has responded to Russian actions with continued resolve. While Ukraine is not a member of NATO and is not seeking NATO membership, Russia's actions are still of concern to NATO members because, over the long term, Russia is likely to test NATO's purpose, stamina, and commitment. Future generations will note whether at this moment, said Secretary Hagel, we summoned the will to invest in our alliance. We must not squander this opportunity or shrink from this challenge. We will be judged harshly by history and by future generations if we do. NATO members must demonstrate that they are as committed to this alliance as its founding members were, who built it 65 years ago. They must reaffirm the security guarantees at the heart of the alliance. They must reinvigorate the unrivaled joint planning, exercises, and capabilities that are its lifeblood. And ultimately, they must be prepared to invest more resources in their militaries. Defense investment not only helps grow economies, but it deters the higher costs of future conflict. But investing in NATO means more than just military investment. It means the U.S. and Europe must partner together over the long term to bolster Europe's energy security and blunt Russia's coercive energy policies. By the end of the decade, Europe is positioned to reduce its natural gas imports from Russia by more than 25%. And the U.S. Department of Energy has conditionally approved export permits for American liquefied natural gas that add up to more than half of Europe's gas imports from Russia. The United States remains committed to the NATO alliance. Without deep engagement in the world, said Secretary Hagel, America would face more conflict, not less.
and on the terms of our adversaries, not on our own terms. That is why America's commitment to its allies in Europe and around the world is not a burden. It's not a luxury, but it is a necessity, and it must be unwavering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.